What should the public demand of historians, and what can historians offer to the public? I'm sure that the title of this conference, History and the Public, will be treated by many here as synonymous with the more familiar phrase, public history. We'll be talking about enlarging audience, breaking down barriers, and democratizing historical knowledge. Judged by those aspirations, history is in better health, I think, than for quite a long time. Through heritage funding, historians have developed closer links with a whole range of community projects. Their work is at the heart of the politics of multiculturalism. And through family history and local history, a bridgehead has been secured between public narratives and individual experience. History is more readily owned by ordinary people, and historians are more confident that their voice will be heard. None of this was anticipated, I think, in 1987 by David Cannadine when he cast a pessimistic eye over history's prospects in his article, British History, Past, Present, and Future, the most significant part of that title being the question mark, which appeared after the word future. 20 years on, history's place in the national culture seems a good deal more secure. My contention is that the activities which we normally place under the banner of public history represent only one part of our responsibility to the public. Many of those activities reflect a passionate concern with belonging. Belonging to the nation, to an ethnic or religious group, to a locality or family. History is seen as fundamentally affirmative, and the cultural depth it offers refers primarily to a sense of identity. Let's be clear about it. This is essential knowledge for a multicultural society, as it is for a society in which the individual sense of belonging has been severed by social or spatial mobility. So the last thing I want to do this morning is to disparage public history as currently understood. My concern is with what is left out of this definition conventionally. Although the profile of public history is growing, it's still mainly associated with a handful of largely cultural concerns. What gets lost sight of is the claim by historians to have a distinctive mode of understanding the world which is applicable to every contentious topic in our society and not just the roots of contemporary identity. My suggestion in this lecture is that public debate would be enhanced by the wider application of historical thinking, or thinking with history, as Karl Schorska has put it. To be specific, I'm referring here to the fundamental principles of historicism, which inform our academic practice. The inherent otherness of the past, or if you like, the gulf that separates present from past. The idea of historical process, which makes intelligible the way in which the otherness of the past became the more familiar world of the present. And the holistic approach, which insists that nothing can be examined in isolation, but only in the light of its full context. These very familiar skills of the historian need no full discussion from me, but in their applied form, I would call them practical historicism. And we can perhaps exploit to our advantage the jargon of the day and say that they are transferable skills, whose potential is seriously underestimated, not least, I would suggest, by historians themselves. Let me indicate what this agenda might mean in practice with reference to an almost two-pointed illustration, the occupation of Iraq. The mounting sense of crisis during the run-up to war in 2003 produced an immense volume of press comment. Almost all of it either expanded on the horrors perpetrated by Saddam or speculated about the motives of the Bush administration. For most analysts, the relevant time depth extended no further back than the first Gulf War in 1990. There was almost no mention of Britain's earlier relations with Iraq, and above all, the League of Nations mandate from 1920 to 1932, when Britain ruled the country as an occupying power. Now, in some ways, it has to be conceded that this seems a somewhat remote episode. At that time, Iraq was wrested from the Ottoman Empire, the Raj in India was still a going concern, and Iraq was thought to bear directly on Indian security. But the mandate period provides food for thought, I think, in two ways. First, it directs attention to the intentions of the occupiers, both declared and concealed. During the 1920s, British interests in Iraq were essentially strategic. But these interests were not confined to Indian concerns. Oil was by this time the preferred fuel for the Royal Navy, and it was in short supply. At the time when Britain took over in Iraq, no oil had actually been found there, but it was generally presumed to exist. Well before drilling began around Kirkuk in 1927, oil was central to British interest in Iraq, though officials minimized their references to that fact in public. By 1934, oil from northern Iraq was flowing freely via the new pipeline to Haifa on the Mediterranean. Secondly, significant elements of the Iraqi population took up arms against the British administration. The Arab Revolt of 1920 was sufficiently serious to prompt the British to abandon direct rule altogether and instead to govern through a client regime. But King Faisal's appointment in 1921 did not fundamentally alter the situation. Major revolts occurred in 1923 and 1931 involving both Arabs and Kurds. The difference was that now the British relied less on ground troops and more on aerial bombing. In fact, the RAF became a regular arm of the administration, routinely deployed against tax defaulters. As the colonial secretary put it after a visit to Iraq in 1925, if the writ of King Faisal runs effectively through this kingdom, it is entirely due to British aeroplanes. It would be idle to affect any doubt on that point. If the aeroplanes were removed tomorrow, the whole structure would inevitably fall to pieces. The parallels with the coalition experience in 2003 up to the present are all too obvious. The point of bringing them into public awareness is not to suggest that history is destined to repeat itself. It is to broaden public awareness of the possible or likely turn of events today. The present crisis may or may not be driven by the politics of oil, but knowing something of the Mandate era might have induced a little more skepticism about official statements to the contrary. And it would have led, I think, to a more realistic estimation of the prospects for stable and secure administration in post-Saddam Iraq. I have read or seen no commentator speculate on how the reception of the British by the population of Basra might be conditioned by memories of their conquest and administration 70 years earlier. Which brings me to the question of dissemination. The quick sketch that I've just given of Iraqi history is drawn from standard works dating back to the 1970s. The findings of Peter Sluglett, Marion Kent, and others are readily accessible. But it would be overstating the case to say that they are in the public domain. In fact, I saw no treatment of this history in a British newspaper or on TV in 2002-3. What we got instead was a far-fetched analogy between Hitler and Saddam Hussein and a dusting down of the great cautionary tale of Munich. The almost exclusive focus of the press on these imagined parallels is telling evidence of the impoverishment of historical awareness in our society, which I suggest we should be doing more to address. Here was a well-developed historiography bearing directly on the present. Why has it made so little impression on public debate? Part of the blame can be attributed to the government, since New Labour, in its public pronouncements at least, seems bent on erasing history before 1997. I'm sure that many of us recall Tony Blair's statement to Congress shortly after the Iraq War that there had never been a time when a study of history provided so little instruction for the present. Some responsibility can also be placed at the door of the media. No one could complain, of course, that history is ignored, especially on TV. But giving in-depth historical perspective on current issues is not high, I think, on the list of priorities. Indeed, the acknowledged entertainment value of history tends the other way. In news reporting, vivid portrayal of the immediate tends to squeeze out historical depth. And I recall Kate Adie in this very hall 2 years ago deploring the fact that reporters usually arrive in the field with no historical background, and that the media courses, she seemed to have a great deal in for the media studies courses, have paid no attention to history either. But it would be unfair to load all this on the politicians and on the media. Responsibility must equally be borne by professional historians for taking what might be called a minimalist line on how the public good might be served. We historians should not complain of our declining place in political culture, as a number of assembled distinguished historians did at the British Academy just before Christmas, if we're not prepared to intervene in public. And this brings me to the nub of my argument. Historians have traditionally shied away from relevance. The last book to urge the need for that kind of history in a direct, upfront way, Connell Smith and Lloyd's Relevance of History in 1972, was greeted by an almost deafening silence. As historians, we've been brought up to justify our studies for their intrinsic importance, the value of history for its own sake, not for their practical relevance. Beginning a historical inquiry with some kind of applicability in mind is suspect, because of the danger that present preoccupations will be imposed on the past, that the resulting history may be partisan. The eminent medievalist T.F. Tout rejected what he called a gross and direct utility for his subject. For Elton, it was the cardinal error. The influential philosopher Michael Oakeshott sought to formalize this prejudice by drawing a sort of sheep and goats distinction between what he called the practical approach and the historical approach to the past. Well, today it's less common to find history for its own sake upheld with quite the same Puritan zeal. A growing number of scholars are reaching out to a very broad public indeed, in print or on the small screen, without compromising standards. But in most cases, their work is not conceived as an intervention in current public debate. Only a handful of historians, Eric Hobsbawm, Linda Colley, Richard Overy, come to mind, directly address a topical, social, or political issue. I'm not talking now about historians whose research is intended from the start to have a direct impact on public debate. There is a case to be made for such work, which I don't intend to pursue here. What concerns me much more is the public dissemination of historical scholarship, regardless of whether it was initiated by topical preoccupations. A great deal of history which has not been framed by topical concerns nevertheless has topical implications. Much of it can and should feed into the stock of public knowledge. I want to develop the argument by means of two slightly more extended case studies, one from international history and the other from British domestic history. And since I'm drawing on established secondary literature, the ground will be familiar to many of you, but I hope that you'll bear with me for the sake of the inferences that I want to draw from this material. Let us take first the history of globalization. Globalization is generally considered to be the distinguishing characteristic of our age, the quintessence of modernity. But before we relegate the world prior to 1945 to a prehistoric limbo, consider the historical implications of what might be regarded as the ideal model of globalization. This is a world where the leading commercial powers practice free trade, where their currencies are held in stable exchange rates, where there is uncontrolled intercontinental migration, and where up-to-date systems of communication are being extended to every corner of the globe. Only the last of those criteria applies to the world in 2006. Most of the G8 apply protection to their key products. The currency markets are dysfunctionally volatile, and migration is fiercely controlled. In fact, the description I've just given, or the criteria I've just listed, correspond much more exactly to the world as it was about 130 years ago. In the 1870s, the leading industrialized and industrializing countries subscribed to the free trade system advocated by Britain. All their currencies were convertible at a fixed rate against gold. There was large-scale free migration from Europe to the Americas, as well as directed migration from India and China to Africa and the Caribbean. The telegraph was cutting down communication times from weeks to hours, while the steamship was improving the speed and comfort of passenger travel. Hobsbawm's brilliant description of this in The Age of Capital is appropriately titled The World Unified. Martin Daunton has applied the term high globalization to the later 19th century, and it can at least be argued that globalization then was more complete than it is now. The conclusion to be drawn from this is that globalization has not, as sometimes imagined, sprung like a new agenda from the long post-war economic boom or from the collapse of communism after 1989. It's a long-term process in which much of what seems new today is no more than an increase of degree beyond what existed a generation or so ago. There are two more specific points to be made before we leave globalization. First, the somewhat invidious comparison I was drawing between the late 19th century and the beginning of the 21st century points to the fact that globalization cannot be assumed to be a smooth trajectory. It's had a decidedly bumpy ride. According to some historians, a globalization backlash was in evidence as early as the 1880s, when several of Britain's competitors turned protectionist. Then, in the first half of the 20th century, globalization went into reverse as a result of two world wars, the International Depression, and the autarkic economic systems of Russia and Germany. Levels of trade and capital flows were not restored to their 1913 levels until, well, it would be nice to take a poll around the room as to the point when those levels were restored, but I'll give you the answer right away. It's the 1980s. This was deglobalization with a vengeance. It should make us cautious about assuming an uninterrupted advance in globalization in the future. The second and final point to make about globalization concerns the intimate connection between globalization and coercion. Victorian Britain proclaimed the virtues of internationalism and progress, but in weaker societies which did not see the light, like West African chiefdoms at one extreme, the Chinese Empire at the other, freedom of movement for goods and capital was enforced at gunpoint. Today, more discreet methods are employed to compel less developed countries to adopt free trade against their own interests. Reinforcing that pressure is an approved version of the history of development, which is a travesty of the facts. As Harjun Chung has reminded us, the majority of advanced capitalist economies reached economic liftoff by the protectionist route. They didn't have free trade during the key early stages. They knew that their infant industries had to be nurtured and set their tariffs accordingly. This was true of the USA for most of the 19th century. It was true of France and Germany in the latter part of the century and the Asian tigers after 1945. And it was true of Britain itself during the critical takeoff period before 1846. Free trade was the preferred system for Britain once its industrial lead was comfortably secure, not while it was an apprentice. In requiring less developed countries to adopt free trade policies, the developed world today is asking them to kick away the ladder, as it's been put, and condemn themselves to continuing economic subordination. As Harjun Chang demonstrates, this is to deny the overwhelming evidence of the historical record. Now, to anyone with an outline knowledge of British economic and imperial history, there'll be nothing new here. But these points scarcely feature in the globalization debate. Historians have a role to play, not by signing up to a particular theory of globalization, but by bringing into the public domain some pertinent historical perspectives. Here, the critical one is that of trajectory or process. The implications of globalization and its future prospects can only be grasped if it's understood as the latest stage in a centuries-long process and one which has been uneven and subject to unpredicted upsets. Far from being outside history, globalization turns out to be a prime candidate for practical historicism. So much for my first case study. The second case study does not have the same global resonance, and it might seem almost parochial by comparison. It is the subject of English local government. Today, that system is generally conceded to be in bad shape because the power of local authorities to set their own budgets and carry through their own policies is so constrained, which in turn means low electoral turnout and a patchy and indifferent standard of candidates for local councils. What happens if we look back to periods when local government was in better health? Consider, first of all, the 1870s and 1880s, when modern municipal government took shape. This is the centerpiece of Tristram Hunt's book, Building Jerusalem. Hunt makes telling comparisons with the present, but the contrast and what can be learned from it is much more fully developed by the Cambridge historian Simon Schretter. The mid-Victorian period was when the modern idea of accountable and technocratic municipal authorities came into being. Cities like Birmingham and Manchester built for the future. They aimed to transform the lives of their citizens by intervening decisively in social welfare and public health. In order to achieve that, they were prepared to challenge the shibboleths of the day, notably by extending public ownership of utilities, the so-called gas and water socialism. Schretter identifies the preconditions of this age of enlightened municipalism. Firstly, there was a culture of civic pride and service to the community, which was initially urged by the nonconformist churches and then taken up by business leaders like Joseph Chamberlain. Secondly, there was a buoyant electoral base, recently expanded by the Second Reform Act. And thirdly, municipal councils exercised financial autonomy, which allowed them to raise rates and to take out loans to finance ambitious schemes of improvement. This autonomy was important because it enabled cities to build up programs finely attuned to local particularities, rather than apply a kind of one-size-fits-all model devised by Whitehall. Schretter maintains that in late Victorian local government, New Labour will find an extraordinary treasure chest of parallels and analogies. Well, that may be overstating it a little bit, but certainly one telling point to be made is the conclusion that progress can be made when the energies and resourcefulness of local communities are unlocked. Local government needs once more to be able to call on the services of the ablest and the most public-spirited, and to motivate the electorate to go to the polls. And for that to happen, local government must have the freedom to develop policies suited to local circumstances, and it must have greater financial autonomy in doing so. Is that likely to happen? If this analogy is to amount to anything more than a pious hope, both the then and the now have to be fully contextualized. In each case, we have to tease out the enabling conditions. In the case of the Victorian civic gospel, these conditions were, I would suggest, a restricted franchise, a culture of deference, and a strong ethic of public service. The first of those was eliminated by stages over the next 50 years, culminating in universal franchise in the 1930s, and the other two declined more gradually over a longer period. The same kind of analysis must be applied to local government as it exists today in order for this analogy to be explored. Here we can turn to the recent work of Jerry White on the history of London, a particularly appropriate author because he's not only a prize-winning historian, but an ombudsman for local government. His starting point is the 1930s, when some of the most innovative responses to the slump were made by elected councils in London and elsewhere. This was the heyday of Herbert Morrison, or Mr. London, as he was called. Between them, the LCC and the borough councils controlled hospitals and health services, emergency services, poverty relief, education, even electricity production, much more than what their successors control today. White pinpoints two periods in which the local democratic control of services was dismantled. One of these was, unsurprisingly, Margaret Thatcher's time in office, when privatization drained away many of the powers of local councils to special interest bodies like housing associations and school governing bodies, which had only a very partial accountability to the wider community. The other period is perhaps not so predictable. It's the creation of the welfare state itself in the immediate post-war years. The new services brought in by the Attlee government were managed from the top. The Health Minister, Aneurin Bevan, pushed through the centralisation of the NHS, including the voluntary hospitals, in the teeth of opposition from local interests. And that centralist approach to social services has remained a strong influence in the Labour Party ever since. New Labour is currently intensifying the switch to special purpose bodies at the local level, for example, in foundation hospitals and in foundation schools. White makes the telling point that far from being a novel and progressive solution, these institutions hark back to the plethora of special purpose bodies in the Victorian period, for sewers, for public libraries, and so on, which were streamlined and democratized by the reformers 100 years ago. The practical inference to be drawn from White's work is that centralism is a Labour vice as well as a Tory one, and that this needs to be kept in mind when interpreting present-day Labour statements about the welfare state. Now, I'm well aware that the use of historical analogy finds few defenders in the historical profession, despite the fact that historians themselves inevitably engage in analogical thinking in the course of their research. They give it a very wide berth in their overt statements to the public. They deplore, quite rightly, the sloppy thinking which leads to Saddam Hussein being identified with Adolf Hitler. And it's true that popular analogies of this kind are usually at odds with the key historicist concepts of process and difference. Invoking our predecessors' experience as a guide to conduct all too easily overlooks the gulf of time which separates them from us. It also discounts the process of change and development which has taken place in the meantime. Too many analogies assert a near identity between then and now, and thus serve to close down debate. The implication of these arguments is that historical analogy not only tells us little, it may actually stand in the way of other more valid insights. However, the real benefits of analogical thinking depend not on a presumed convergence between past and present, but on the interplay of similarity and difference. Simon Schretter and Jerry White are not suggesting that history repeats itself or that their chosen periods offer a blueprint for reform. That could hardly be the case given the shifts in political culture which have occurred in the meantime. Chamberlain's Birmingham and Herbert Morrison's London are prescriptive in the sense of being held up as models of best practice, but this hardly forecloses other options in the minds of these two writers. If anything, there is a morbid sense of what the alternatives are all too likely to be. Each writer is opposed to the recent emasculation of local government and concerned to rescue from present-day pragmatism certain principles of governance which were expressed in the 1870s. Which were expressed between the 1870s and the 1930s. What is wrong today and what might be done to correct it are better understood by looking at those more confident times. Well, I must wind up, and the last point I want to make, or the last question I want to pose, is how the sort of perceptions that I've been describing should be fed into the public domain. Or to put it bluntly, who are historians talking to when they write on topics of this kind? I think there are two possible audiences. One is the policy makers in government and in that penumbra of think tanks and policy units which surrounds it. This is an important dimension of public history in the United States, and historians have had a recognized role in government there since at least the 1980s. The other audience, and it's the one which interests me rather more, is the general public. It rests on the conviction that historical perspective is a vital part of the citizen's capacity to reflect and to act. In the case of both Schretter and White, audience was a central concern. Their interventions first appeared on the History and Policy website. David Bates mentioned in his introductory remarks the History and Policy Unit, which is about to get off the ground, hosted by the Institute, and that is the culmination of three years of a website run on a shoestring, which is now hopefully going to enter the mainstream. This is the History and Policy website, www.historyandpolicy.org, founded in 2003 by a group of historians in Cambridge and London to make available historical findings with implications for policy. Since then, it has posted more than 30 short papers. Most of them are kind of distillation of longer and more fully documented work by the authors on topics as various as terrorism post 9/11, foundation hospitals, and the gendered curriculum in schools, and many others. The website also includes two very illuminating pieces about Iraq, both written about the time of the invasion itself by Beverly Milton Edwards and John Dower. The website was planned with the intention of reaching the corridors of power as well as disseminating the findings through the media to a wider public. It may be that in attempting to reach both these audiences, the website has spread itself too thin and diluted its impact. But it should be borne in mind that it's the first attempt in Britain to promote applied history across the broadest front of public issues. And I think with the greater coherence and funding of the unit, its importance will grow. The argument I'm making, then, is for an enlarged conception of public history. How historians should address the public has never been given the priority it deserves. Even now, when there's so much lively two-way communication, the full implications of public history are underestimated. And yet, and I'd like to end on an optimistic note, it seems to me the circumstances at present could hardly be more promising. A government which tries to airbrush the past is particularly exposed to the lessons of history. There is a strong case to be made for practical historicism as part of an education in citizenship, which, after all, is a very live debate at the moment. And we could hardly hope for a higher media profile for history than exists at present, particularly on TV. So I would submit that it's about time that historians took ownership of the social dividend of their discipline. Thank you.
Well, my warmest thanks to John for starting off in such a stimulating and thought-provoking way. We agreed before the lecture started that we would have time for a couple of observations stroke questions. So can I ask for comment and questions from the floor?
Or a single account that needs to be, in a sense, slotted into wider public debate, but actually historians are always arguing amongst themselves about what the right, how we ought to understand a particular issue, whether it's the history of globalisation or the history of their development. And I suppose the minute that you start getting dissenting historical voices into the debate, the tendency then is towards those historians to start talking to each other rather than and arguing over which of them is right, rather than, in a sense, engaging the debate. So I wonder how we sort of, do we have to reach a kind of sense of consensus amongst historians about which story we're going to tell to journalists or to policymakers before we can intervene?
No, absolutely not. It seems to me that one of the contributions that history is so well placed to make to a more mature civic culture is actually to introduce into it the notion that all these questions are indeed matters of debate, and that the point about bringing to bear a late Victorian perspective on local government is not to say this is how you do it, this is the way, but to actually open one's thinking to the fact that there are other ways in the plural, you know, that there are other values to be brought to bear on local government and so on. So it's innately pluralistic, really, what I'm suggesting, and I didn't really bring that out sufficiently. But I would agree, for example, with people like Joyce Appleby, Margaret Hunt, and Jacob, that in their book, Tell the Truth About History, thank you. That telling the truth about history is not a single-track, monolithic thing. And, I mean, I think that we're obviously talking long-term here, because we're talking about quite a sophisticated notion of what the place of history in public consciousness ought to be. And it certainly goes very, very much further than saying, this is what the historians say, you know, QED. And I think it raises also, in turn, very important issues about the national curriculum in history and what it is that kids are going to bring into their adult political life from the perceptions they've gained, but that's another whole story.
I've seen two questions on the far right on that side of the room. We'll take those two and then bring to a conclusion. So yes, please.
Around historians almost and counterposing this to the public. And I was thinking particularly of the examples that you were giving around Iraq. I'm not sure I would really quite like that, because I think issues around, say, on that example of the British involvement in the past in Iraq was actually brought out, but not necessarily by historians, though it was was actually in press. It was, for example, on demonstrations, etc. And why I'm raising that is I think if we're talking about the relationship between historians and broader audiences, it might be also illuminating to look, if you like, at a blurring of boundaries. Mm-hmm. That rather than saying, if you like, there's a professionalist, academicist, historian, rather perhaps looking at who is actually writing history, which I think that actually opens this out far more rather than having these rigid categories.
Yes, I mean, I have a good deal of sympathy with that. At the same time, I think where I'm coming from is a sense throughout my career that there are huge resources of understanding locked up in the academic history profession, which are simply not being communicated in ways that would be genuinely stimulating and genuinely illuminating to a wider public. So, of course, that model is fairly kind of oil and water, I agree with you. And there wasn't time in my paper to talk about the kinds of collaborative work or the way in which historians can be relating to community history and more political understandings that come from the community. I mean, all that, I think, needs to be taken up as well. But the essential one I wanted to get across was that there's so much that historians have done, and in the case of Iraq, done in the 1970s, which may have been reflected in street demonstrations, but it certainly wasn't on TV, and it wasn't on the main broadsheet newspapers.
That tells you more about the media than it does about
the science. I agree. Yeah. You have to go on both fronts.
Can I say something good about the media and where we're going to since the Gulf War? Because I think the time is really right, particularly in current affairs, for historians to follow this up in the media because they realise that there are problems. And it's been very hard to kind of make the spaces work, but there's a small group of us who've been campaigning within the BBC to make the spaces happen. And is Greg Neil here? Because Greg Neil, it's the first time on TV news that there is a dedicated history correspondent. So Greg.Neil at bbc.co.uk is a place to feed things through into Newsnight. And then I've been working too great before to try and address this. It's a project, we call it The Lost Dimension. And, so that's our kind of coding for it. But this woman said too about feeding them a line is really important. At the moment, they can't cope with multiple voices. So I think giving them one line at a time is the first way to do the door. And then possibly then the next phase could be leading them into kind of multiple ways of thinking.
I'd noticed several questions, but we'll take the last one over there. Thank you.
I think there's a gap between your policymakers and your general community, which is also a bridge. And this is the people we teach, and what we teach, and how we teach, because they're not going to be professional historians. The link between Basra and Birmingham needs to be made. There have to be connections. And the connections have to be made through the manner in which we teach, and the work that the people we teach do as part of a process of making history. And I think that becomes the bridge over that gap.
I think there are all sorts of bridges, and I think, as I hinted a moment ago, what goes on in the schools, whether through the national curriculum or through other means, is absolutely critical. And what really interests me in the longer term is the hope that some of the modes of historical thinking which we in this room take for granted will have a wider dissemination, so that what people do in adult life is not so much say, oh, I learnt about this in school, as I learnt in school how to approach this. In other words, what kinds of understanding might be applicable about Iraq, which, of course, I didn't study when I was in school 20 years ago, but which I can see my way now to understanding in a fuller sense. So I could very easily have made this a lecture about, you know, my hopes for the school system, but that has to be for another day and for another conference. But I think it's absolutely critical, and in some sense it's reassuring that once again the content and mode of delivery in the national curriculum seems to be open to genuine debate again. I mean, it may close down again soon, who knows? But I think we seize that opportunity.
Well, at this point, I must firmly draw discussion to a conclusion.